I have a text in the fifth chapter of Matthew, a part of the Sermon on the Mount, that I'd like to read for you. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. There's a couple of qualities that I don't want us to go over lightly. In the first place, it said, if men say evil against you falsely for the sake of Christ, is the requirement to bring that blessing. If we deserve to have evil spoken of us, or if it is not in defense of the Lord, it is of no value. And this isn't to try to promote the idea that we should endeavor to live in such a way as to bring persecution upon ourselves. But when it comes, if it meets that qualification that the Lord has laid down, he pronounces a blessing upon his people. There are a great many times throughout the history that's recorded in the scripture when men were persecuted and reviled because they endeavored to do the Lord's will. And I want to bring one of them that is among the more familiar to your remembrance. It happened in the time of Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar erected a golden image about 90 feet tall and issued a decree that all the people, when they heard the instruments of music play at their appointed times, that they were to stop and fall down and worship this image. The three companions of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, had been elevated to rather high positions in the government over the province of Babylon, and they didn't bow to this image and worship. And when this was brought to the attention of King Nebuchadnezzar, he was pretty angry about it. And he called them before him and he said, how is it that you have dared to defy my edict and that you refuse to bow before my image? And they told him pretty calmly, well, we worship our God and that's all we worship. And he said, don't you know that I have the power to put you in a furnace of fire according to the decree that I decreed? And they said, well, that may be. And they told him further that if it please our God to condescend to us, he can take care of us. And if it doesn't please him to condescend, it doesn't make that much difference because we won't do it anyway because it isn't right. So, I want to begin to read then at the 19th verse of this chapter 3, and it's rather lengthy. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Take note that they had all their clothes on when they were thrown in that fire. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spake, and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth out of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose body the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. This is a great deal more than simply to save a man out of the fire, isn't it? When they were cast into such a fire as that, and it had no effect on the fabric of their clothes, not even to make the smell of a fire upon it, nor to singe a hair on their bodies. It's incredible. It's more than we can imagine what the power of God is. And this really was the message that I want us to think about, is that the power of God is above and beyond all of the grandest imaginations of men. That the power that was shown them there is available according to the need of men, according to the faith that they exercise in God, any day, any time, any need that they may have. It's kind of a sobering thought to know that such an awesome power is poised, ready, willing, and able to help you when you need it in exchange for an unfaltering belief and a willingness to try to discern. And then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies that they may not serve, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. This man realized that there was a God whom the Israelites served, because he had had a considerable amount of experience with Daniel already and saw the workings of God, but he was not willing yet at that time to yield to God himself, and even at the time of this writing was not yet willing. But he did see to that degree that he would speak in this way and go further, go beyond that, and make a decree concerning those who did worship God. Therefore, I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. In other places, he decreed almost the same thing, that they should not be prevented. And he was not the only king in Babylon to whom the power of God was shown, and they were obliged by their conscience to give permission that in that idolatrous nation, which was a vile place, that men be allowed to worship the God of heaven and do it without anyone to limit or prevent their worship. I never cease to be amazed when I think and read of these things, that God was able to do these things and that he is so very willing to do them. In the ministry of Paul, as he wrote his several epistles, he warns that men would resist God, would resist the understanding of God. These kings in Babylon resisted that understanding as long as they could. And we know the other stories concerning them, and they had strange and marvelous things happen to them. Things that are a testimony to you and me and to every generation of men who has lived in all the intervening time and needs to for a long time yet. And these things are pretty valuable. They're pretty precious to us because they're preserved for us to be an example and a testimony so that we don't, so that we have no occasion to question and wonder and worry. Now, is this really true? I had a man in conversation a number of years ago told me that he would like very much to know that there was another life after this life. Well, I told him, I can't prove to you that there is. I said, I have all the confidence I need for myself, and I can testify to you of that and why I have it. But I can't prove that you're going to live again. But these things, as we become acquainted with them, they heap proof upon upon proof to help persuade us and to give us peace of mind and that comfort to the degree that we almost feel that we know. Because we're told that faith is the substance of things hoped for. It is body, it is real to us, and that's the way it ought to be. It gives a measure of proof that to the soul of man goes almost to the point of knowledge, but not quite. And yet Paul was obliged, and I want to read some from Timothy and from Thessalonians, where he tells that men would resist this understanding, and that they would become the victims of their own unbelief, and that the blessings of God would become unavailable to this type of people. In 2 Timothy, the third chapter, if I better read the first verse for you. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. He outlines for him then a number of things that men would do. Traits that we see among people all around us today. Not simply the rich and the learned, but poor and miserable people, and everybody in all walks of life between, who would become as vicious to each other and as immoral as these things are that he describes. People who scramble to the degree that the common expression in the world is to call it a rat race, because they're striving for what isn't going to bring them satisfaction, but they're hoping that it is. And they strive to the degree of destroying each other, very much like you might expect a bunch of unprincipled animals, but they become worse than animals who only struggle to exist. And he says of these people that in the midst of all this great rush towards something undefined that doesn't ever bring them what they want, that there is those in old times. I'm going to begin to read again at verse 8. Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so did these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith. But they shall proceed no further, for their folly shall be made manifest, or shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. These men were the sorcerers of Pharaoh. These are the men who stood and performed marvelous appearing things by the power of the devil at the time that Moses stood with his rod to perform the wonders to persuade Pharaoh that God had sent him to instruct him to let the people of Israel go free. If you remember that story, it began only to allow them to travel into the desert and to let them be free to worship God accordingly as they wanted to. And eventually it had to come to the point that they were to be set free and allowed to go out and not live any longer under bondage in Egypt. But these two withstood Moses, withstood God, mocked against God, and did great wonders in the eyes of the people. And yet, it tells us here that their folly was made manifest, and it is because we see that it fell before the power of God, because they were laboring in the power of quite another spirit that could not compare itself even to God, except in the minds of the unbelievers. Back in the Second Thessalonian letter, the second chapter, I want to read just a little bit more. This is speaking of the age that we live in. He had told the people that the day of the Lord was not upon them, because they were being taught, beware, the end is imminent. It's going to be any time now. And Paul said, no, it's not. He said, there's going to be a falling away. And then it's necessary that there be a revealing of the power that has brought about this falling away. He called him the man of sin, the son of perdition. He calls him all sorts of things and tells of his power over the children of men, and of things that we have not yet seen, but it is certain that there's going to be. Because he tells them there that the mystery of this iniquitous organization was already at work, and it's going to increase, and it's going to be revealed in the eyes of all men when they'll see that it is a wicked power doing great and marvelous things. It said, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all powers and signs and lying wonders. I'm reading the ninth verse. And all with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned, who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Now there are several qualifications here that are promoted by that evil which is called in the Book of Mormon the great and abominable church, under whose wings all the evil of the world is eventually to be organized under one head to make war against the Spirit of God and those that God has chosen. And it says, because they resist this understanding and have delight in the things that are not true, they couldn't receive a love of the truth because they resist the learning and don't want to have any part of it. Then he says that God will cause that they be deluded by it, that the truth have no part in them, and it's no longer available to them, even to that degree that their pleasure in unrighteousness shall bring them down to a damned condition. It's kind of terrible to think about. But he said that this power would work signs and lying wonders. Signs and lying wonders that have continued until now, sometimes to a lesser degree and sometimes to more. But today we see them very much on the increase. Wednesday evening in our prayer, scripture study here, we discussed a little bit of them. But for a great many years, I suppose a good number of hundreds of years, it's been a practice among the people of India and that general area that they've had those who make a great thing of calling themselves holy men, and they endure apparently all sorts of incredible physical tortures with no harm. They walk on coals of fire barefoot, and the coals don't scorch their feet. They haven't toughened their feet and made them a leathery callus. They show no damage. They lie on beds of nails, and their skin isn't harmed. And they do a great many other things, and I believe in my own mind that they haven't done these things at all. That they have been able to hypnotize large groups of people until they think that they see those things. Because I know other instances of mass hypnosis when people were very certain that they saw a thing that they did not see. Now this is an awesome thing when you stop to think that a person might have a power within himself whereby he can control the minds of a large number, maybe hundreds or even a thousand or more people at a time until they all think they see the same thing which does not exist. This is a little bit terrible. It's something to be alarmed about. And yet the world has shrugged its shoulders and said, well, there's no explanation for it. Well, there is an explanation for it, and it is the power of the devil doing lying wonders to confuse and bewilder the minds of men and to alienate them from thinking upon the things that God is able and willing to do for them, to keep them from believing in God. To cause them to live in fear and cause them to have no desire for any association with God because they think that that's the power of God and it's terrible. We have better to hope for than that. I'd like to read Psalm 124 for us. If it had not been for the Lord who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they had swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us. Then the waters had overwhelmed us. The stream had gone over our soul. Then the proud waters had gone over our soul. Blessed be the Lord who hath not given us as a prey to their teeth. Our soul is escaped as a bird out of a snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we are escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. He speaks first of the physical enemies of Israel. And then he goes on and uses figures of speech to me, this is the way I understand it, to indicate that the pride and the overwhelming tide of the opinions and the actions of the people would flow over them and engulf them and swarm over them until they were unable to resist if it were not for the Lord. And here we are, the barest handful of people, and do we suppose for a moment that we would survive in this world today, spiritually, on our own strength and wisdom, that we don't need God continually as a buffer zone between us and the overwhelming tide of contrary opinion, contrary practices, of the attractions of the carnal that are held before us continually? We would not survive. There is no possibility were it not for God who is on our side. You know, he won't remain on our side if we passively give him permission and say, okay, God, you can come along and help me out if I happen to need you. He said in the very first book of the Bible that the Spirit of God will not always strive with man. And it won't. It's necessary that the man make himself an instrument that God can use, that he make himself available to God, that he be obedient to God. I'm sure that all of us have heard the definition of the Indian sage concerning conscience. And after all, conscience is the big thing that we're trying I've lost the word that I was going to use, but to get up and moving. The conscience that enters into our mind without our consciously seeking for direction, because it's there, it's very present all the time, and if we move it to some zeal, it'll help us a lot. At any rate, this Indian wise man, whoever he was, that is an American Indian, says that conscience is a wheel with three points on it. And that whenever he started to do something wrong, it would begin to turn. But if he didn't pay any attention to it long enough, the points would all wear off and it wouldn't bother him anymore. Now that really is conscience. It pricks us any time that we begin to go astray. But we're free to go on astray if we like, and it won't be too long until it ceases to labor with us. And that's what the Lord said, that He won't always struggle with a man. If we will promote a little vigor in that conscience of ours and keep it promoted, He will. I'd like to read for you out of the words of Moroni, where it tells us that we are endowed with that conscience and how much it's worth to us. On page 764, the 7th chapter of Moroni, 13th verse. "For behold, my brethren, it is given to you to judge, that you may know good from evil, and the way to judge is as plain that you may know with a perfect knowledge as the daylight is from the dark night. For behold, the Spirit of Christ is given to every man that they may know good from evil. Wherefore, I shew unto you the way to judge, for everything which inviteth to do good and to persuade to believe in Christ is sent forth by the power and the gift of Christ." It's given to every man, he says, to know good from evil. It's an endowment of the Spirit of God, and it's within you when you come to a mental capacity of understanding to be responsible for your acts, you know right from wrong. And so does everybody else. And because of that, he says, every man knows, and then if the thing that you observe and consider would entice you to believe upon Christ, it's good. Now, there are a lot of things that acknowledge Christ to you that don't entice you to believe, because belief carries a lot on its back. Belief carries obedience on its back, because if there is no obedience, the belief was not genuine. It was not real. It was not active. "Wherefore, you may know with perfect knowledge it is of God. But whatsoever thing persuadeth men to do evil, and believe not in Christ, and deny Him, and serve not God, then ye may know with perfect knowledge it is of the devil. For after this manner doth the devil work, for he persuadeth no man to do good, no, not one, neither doth his angels, neither do they subject themselves, they who subject themselves unto him." Now, those few words by themselves are not really quite enough. I don't want to use that for the subject of the evening. It's already half gone. But he said that you've got to take a lot of heed and care. Even in other places, admonishes that we do a great deal of praying over this understanding, that we don't judge in our minds what's good to be evil or what's evil to be good, because we're not always wise enough to choose. And here he says, the evil spirit entices men to do evil. And yet we're not always qualified to choose that, because usually we don't see enough of the deed. And sometimes the surface of the deed looks good, while the deed itself is evil of a high order. And now we're getting to something a little sticky, and it pertains very strongly to us, to everyone that we know, to everyone whom we ever will become acquainted with after we have been endowed with this good conscience. "Now, my brethren, seeing that ye know the light by which ye may judge, which light is the light of Christ, see that ye do not judge wrongfully. For with that same judgment which ye judge, ye shall also be judged. Wherefore, I beseech of you, brethren, that you should search diligently in the light of Christ, that you may know good from evil. And if you will lay hold upon every good thing and condemn it not, ye certainly will be a child of Christ." Take it and think very seriously about it, because it's reckless and it's dangerous to be harsh in our judgments. Now, we have to judge acts and deeds and decide whether or not in our minds to follow them. We have not the right to judge people, ever. Not ever. Because that is presuming ourselves to be qualified to take upon ourselves a part of the labor of God. That's His realm. It's not ours, and it's not ever to become our realm. And people often delve into it, and it's dangerous to themselves. It's reckless. It's foolish. It's too frightening to ignore, and we need to think about it a lot because we can afford to be charitable with men. We're asking God not for justice, but for mercy. Every solitary one of us, if we admit it to ourselves or not, we want more than we deserve from God. And God has promised us more than we deserve. And if we are not willing to give more than our fellow man deserves to him, we will not get mercy from God. It's as simple as that. I believe this very strongly, and I can't overemphasize it to you because I think it's very important that we consider it much more personally than we ever have before. We're approaching the climax of the world's history, and this is an important detail in your life and mine. Our every conversation can very easily bring us to a point where we have to make this choice, and we have to make it right. The Apostle Paul, in his treatise on charity, says if we don't have it, we're nothing. That isn't very encouraging, is it? We have to entertain that charity, and that charity, which is the pure love of Christ, is the liberality of mind toward the other person, and especially toward the weak. Sometimes I wonder just exactly how the Lord held his mouth when he said, "The poor you have with you always." But we certainly have them with us always, and we always will. And the spiritually and intellectually poor are more numerous than those who are financially poor, and they demand more consideration from us, a great deal more consideration from us, and we must give it. We have not the choice. The Lord did not allow us that choice. Paul said that every sacrifice he could possibly make, even to the sacrifice of his own life and body, was not sufficient if it did not include this willingness to be charitable in our attitude toward other people. You know, as the Lord gives his commandments and as he spoke in parables to the people, oftentimes those applied directly to the people he was talking to and applies just as well to you and me today, and they apply literally. You don't have to give them a vague interpretation that has no teeth. They have teeth. And sometimes they bite us, and sometimes they make us jump quite a ways because they pinch. And I want us to feel a little pinched at times, because usually it takes a little pain to get us up and get us moving again when we're idle. I hope we're not very idle. But these things that I've spoken to you out of the Scriptures, I believe, are to be taken just like we find them written. We read a very, very familiar passage in Timothy that I use to back that up when I'm talking to myself. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Now, if we take the Scriptures which we have laid before us and use them for doctrine, we have only exploited a fourth of their function. He says they're good for reproof. That is to correct the unruly. They're used for correction, to bring to rights what is not correct, what is not what it ought to be, and for instruction in righteousness. It amounts to a lot. Now, we can say that this guy was a crackpot. Maybe he was. He was different from the crowd. But if we're not different from the crowd, we're not charitable, and we're not going to get very far with God, because he has given us these things and testified to us they're true and instructed us to be obedient to us. To it, I mean. all this came about because I just happened to be shopping around in the scriptures a number of weeks ago, and I believe that I read probably what is the most reckless and foolish thing that a group of people ever said. And because I hear people who say things that are almost like this, and it frightens me. It doesn't just give me some pause for thought, it frightens me to hear people when it seems to me that they tempt God, that they stand in defiance and say, I have a right to do whatever I want to do, or say whatever I want to say. At the time that Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate, before he was crucified, Pilate was persuaded that before it was all over that he was who he said he was. And he tried to persuade the people to turn him loose. He said, this man is guiltless. He said, Israel, behold your king. This man is your king. And he inscribed it on the cross in that way. He didn't inscribe it, this man claims to be the king of the Jews. He inscribed it, this man is the king of the Jews, because he believed that this man was the king of the Jews. And he tried to persuade them to turn him loose and they wouldn't have him. Matthew 27:24. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Did you ever stop and consider anything so frightening, so reckless, so foolhardy? As to say, we'll take the blame for it forever. Let it be on us and our children. If it bring destruction, they said they didn't care. They were aroused to such a point of the mob spirit that is moved by the power of the devil that they didn't care. They honestly believed that they did not care. And they said, let the blame be on us and let it be carried on to our children. It's a frightening thing. It's a sobering thing. And one for us to think about that we never, in any tiny degree, entertain in our minds either. They pronounce judgment upon themselves. 12:92. Without chance of mercy, they asked to pronounce judgment upon themselves for taking the life of a man who, by their superior judge, was considered to be innocent. You know, we can afford to lean a long ways back and impress our consciousness pretty hard to beware of taking any such risk with our foolish minds or with any figure of speech. Because we do get carried away by the sound of our own voice, sometimes I think a little hypnotized by what we're saying, to the point that we say things that we do not mean, and then sometimes we're unwilling to back down when we're challenged. And that can get scary. We need a little of the wisdom of Jesus to fish us back out of a place like this. We can talk ourselves into something that we don't know how to deal with. In Matthew 5, the 21st verse, Jesus is dealing with the very type of subject, and then telling how it can enter into the frame of mind in much lesser fashion and still have the same soul impact and move us to the same caution or incaution. Ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. What does he mean? He means just that. He means that if this expression, Raca, as I understand, means worthless, just vain and empty and of no value. Now we hear it continually around us. That guy is just no good. Every solitary one of us has said that. It may be true, but we're not free to judge it. When we judge a person to that degree, we thrust ourselves in our own subconscious into the realm of God to take judgment on ourselves and say if this person is worthy of even of his life or not. It carries all these implications. We don't think of that when we say it, but it does. It implies all these things, and they are binding upon us whether we really deep down mean it or not. We got to ride herd on our own tongue and keep these things from happening. He says, you're not free to judge somebody to be a fool. One who is so empty of mind as to not have any redeeming feature in the welfare of this world. It isn't for you and me. And he means this to you and me. He didn't mean it to 12 people there. He didn't mean it to 2,500, if that happened to be how many people he was teaching at that time. He meant it to you and me just as much as he meant it to them. We need to think about it. We need to think about it rather soberly. Nephi, in his old age, he said, I have charity for the Jew, and I have charity for the Gentile. Which he had, and he proved it. And this is what he was talking about. He had liberal desires for their soul's welfare. He wasn't willing that he should be saved and that they should be lost. He was not willing to give up his salvation, but he was willing to give up a great deal of other things in exchange for the hope of salvation being extended to them. And we need to seek to experience that charity of mind. The world today says a lot of uncharitable things about the Jew. We don't have that privilege, not in the Church of Christ. They are, and they have long been, literally a covenant, chosen, preferred people of God, and they are today. He's made certain promises and covenants with those people that are going to be brought to pass, and we really can't see just how, but it certainly would stand in our stead if we would discipline ourselves to believe that it is true. Let me read a little to you from the 11th chapter of Hebrews concerning this, because I think that it's a lesson in charity of judgment that can be applied to our life. I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Wot ye not that the scripture saith of Elias, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even that so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. That within God's power it has been kept alive, that there are those who are worthy of the grace of God. And though Elijah didn't know it, there were yet 7,000 in a nation that he thought had given themselves completely to evil. There was yet 7,000 people who had not bowed. And while Elijah was being a little uncharitable with them, as he condemned their acts before God, the Lord said, Elijah, you're stepping out of line. You're getting too strong in your talk. It isn't as bad as you think it is. Out of sight somewhere in the world today are a lot of people whose conscience is worthy of the grace of God. And for their welfare, it behooves us to be rather charitable toward men in general. Even those whom we find it the very most difficult to be charitable toward. Of course, Paul was unwilling to say that God had cast away Israel, being an Israelite himself.